Thank you very much. That was delightful. Very pleasant music. I guess that wakes everyone up. I must apologize to you because last week in the closing parts of my sermon I forgot to turn to the scripture I said I would. So I will. It was actually Matthew 25. It wasn't until afterwards it was pointed out and I thought about it, but I'd forgotten to get back to it. So I'll sort of begin by where I left off. If you weren't here last week, I'm sorry about that. Matthew 25, and I was going to read the section, verse 34 to 40. If you can remember this far back, I was talking about oppression and the difficulties that we face in life with oppression in various ways. And verse 34 begins where the king says to those on the right hand, come and inherit, and so on. Verse 35, for when I was hungry, you gave me something to eat, and thirsty, you gave me a drink, and I was a stranger, and you took me in. Whenever I was short of clothes, you helped to clothe me, and when I was sick, you looked after me, and when I was in prison, you came to see me. And the righteous answered in verse 37 and said, well, Lord, well, we didn't see you in this state. When did this happen? In verse 40, the king replied, I tell you the truth, that whenever, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me. And that was the point I was closing on last time, that principle, that issue, that it is important in that Good Samaritan sense that we talked about, those things are seen to be done, and that is a part of our Christian life. So that was the scripture I'd meant to turn to. And it was very much apropos, I thought, the subject and the occasion. Now, speaking of oppression, I'd like to talk to you about children today, and families, and parenting. Now, our children are not necessarily oppressive, perhaps it's the parents who are oppressive, but either way, it has its ups and downs. Some of the greatest stresses today come from the family unit. Of that there is no doubt. Many issues, many perceptions, different things that people see. Even the best of families have hassles and flaws and stresses. And some people have, in the church, spiritual flaws in the sense that they think things will work out in a certain way because they are in the church or because they are religious or whatever it may be. I'll give you some typical case histories of where people feel that things will work out, but in fact it isn't necessarily like that. One is this, that people might say something like, all my problems will be solved if and when I become a Christian. Just by joining the church, suddenly all my problems are solved. And of course the answer is, that's not true. That is not the case. It doesn't work that way. Or another person might say, well, all my problems will be solved because the answers are in the Bible. Well, in principle they may be, but in reality it's finding them and then acting on them. So it may not be because they're in the Bible that you'll find the answers to your problems. Another flaw that people have in their thinking very often is this sort of thing. They'll say, well, if anyone has a problem, it must be that they're sinning. They must be sinning if they have a problem. Well, that's not necessarily true either. Problems can be common to all, whether we're good or bad or indifferent. So these things will come and go. Other people sometimes will say, the Bible has a teaching which if you follow will automatically solve all your problems. Well, that's a catch-all phrase. You could technically argue it might be true, but it doesn't work that way. It isn't that simple. Life doesn't go in that direction. And so, when we think about children, parenting, families, things of that sort, it is good to turn to God for clarification. It is good to turn to God for help with solutions to problems. But I would suggest to you that it's wrong to expect God to solve every problem instantaneously just because we've asked. It doesn't work that way. If you've been around long enough, you'll know it doesn't work that way. To the extent that today people can be very confused about family roles, I mean reflecting society this is, but it also comes through into the church. People can be very confused about family roles and what is required. There's a very famous quote about education and parenting. It goes like this. The education of a child begins 100 years before he or she is born. Now, it's a good quote. And, of course, the implication is that the education of the child is hinged upon the parents and the grandparents beforehand. What your parents and grandparents have set in motion is what you're going to reap. And that, of course, is a difficult one. Very, very difficult. But it's essentially a true statement. So the education of us all begins 100 years before we're born. We're products. Now, you come to our society today, and you look at parenting, and this culture that we live in, and I'll give you some quotes, and I'll show you how confused people are. There's a quote in the papers in the past few weeks, and these are all recent newspaper quotes I'm referring to. The Mothers Union, a fine body of people, said this: "Today, we are overinflating the importance of the nuclear family." And what they preamble was going on to say was, it doesn't have to be two parents, 1.3 children or 2.3 children or whatever it is. That whole nuclear family concept is overrated. They saw it in terms of it doesn't matter what the configuration would be. Now, you can see where they might be coming from, but they're knocking what is an established form of a family structure. And I'm suggesting there's an amount of confusion there. Translate it this way. You know that today, lesbian couples can adopt children. Now, you may or may not approve of that, depending on your own background and feelings and so on. But it's happening a little more frequently in many, many Western countries, perhaps more than we realize. The theory in society is it doesn't really matter. The child can just have as good a time and as healthy a life as anybody else. Now, these are all examples, remember, to show you that I think with parenting, there is confusion out there. There isn't a consensus as to what one should do. The Duchess of York recently is quoted in the papers as saying she doesn't mind if her husband takes the children on a holiday with another woman. I'm just saying to you that I think what you've got in society is a spread of ideas where people are quite confused about parenting. If you understood about the 100-year mark beforehand, you wouldn't so flippantly say it doesn't matter who you go on holiday with or who you sleep with or what happens here or there. Anything. You wouldn't say that if you saw the end result of all of those things that happen. But these people come out with these one-liners. So she says she doesn't mind. I'm suggesting that society is getting messages all the time in culture because of this, from people in society, from people who matter, from people who are leaders. And as a result, people are taking on board messages, well, it doesn't matter here, it doesn't matter there. In England, a senior Anglican clergyman recently said he felt that sex outside of marriage is quite acceptable. Now, he's a senior clergyman. And I'm suggesting that what he says has a great import on the people. And they're affected by it. Now, what do you think? See, these are all parts of society. I know, and probably you know more than I know, because the minister usually finds out last, that we have young people in the church who do sleep around. God forbid. I hope it isn't in your family. I pray it will never happen in your family. But let's not kid ourselves. It does happen within the church. There are people of school age who are essentially in de facto relationships. And you scratch your head and say, well, what's gone wrong? What's happening? Well, I'm suggesting all these things in culture, whether it's the Mothers Union, whether it's a senior clergyman, whether it's the Duchess of York, they're all putting out various messages to this culture, which say you can do this, or it doesn't matter about that, and who cares about the other. And these things are taken on board by all of us, to the extent that we represent what we do. So, let's not assume that we have some immunity from what is happening out there, and let's not assume that our young people are not vulnerable, because they are vulnerable, as indeed we all are. Never mind the young, let's not pick on them. We all are vulnerable, but especially perhaps in that category and age group. Now, on the issue of parenting, does the Bible and the church speak clearly about some things, or are we also confused? Question. I would say that parenting is a very, very demanding role. I think it's very difficult to be a successful parent. I think it's incredibly difficult. I don't think it's the easiest thing in the world. The other thing I should say is that very few people are trained to do it. Very few are trained to do it. And again, I hearken back to the 100-year principle. If you saw it in your parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, you might be a whiz at it. Otherwise, you're struggling like everybody else. So fatherhood and motherhood still become some of the life's great challenges that we face. The Sunday Times had a poll recently. Let me give you some more facts and figures because these are interesting. The Sunday Times poll said 40% of parents polled felt they were unprepared for parenting. 40% felt they were unprepared for parenting. They didn't really know what they were getting into. 30% of parents felt their children were out of control. These are fairly high figures. I don't know what you feel about your children or your family, but 30% of parents at large felt that their children were out of control. How many parents are cool, calm, collected? Some are. I would suggest in most homes you've got a battlefield of conflict and anxiety. It sort of waxes and wanes depending on who's up at the moment. But it comes and goes, or the state of the moon, or whatever it might be, but it comes and goes with a lot of places. There's anxiety and it's a bit of a battlefield for some. But it may be that yours is cool, calm and collected. You've got, they tell us, 18 years to shape a child, give or take a year, before they move on. One wit, and I like this quote, said, most of us would have more success maturing whiskey for 18 years than we would children. It would be far more mature if we sat in a barrel of whiskey. Well, you take the point that it, with whiskey, you just sit on it and do nothing. Maybe the temperature's got to be right. But with children, they come and go and they change day in, day out, year in, year out, relentlessly. Philip Larkin, the poet, he said this. Speaking of parenting, he said, they raise you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extra just for you. Now, again, I think there's some essential truth in that. You'll pick up all the faults of mum and dad and they'll throw in a few more besides for good measure. 40% of parents say they're too soft on their children, feel they should be harder. 12% say they're too hard on their children, feel that they should ease up. 1 in 3 parents admits to having favourites in their children, which is a capital offence. But 1 in 3 admit that they have a favourite child, and that reaps endless problems, which you can read about. What is it that hassles parents most about their children? Let's talk about it this way around. I'll come to the kids later. What is it that parents dislike most in their children? And there are 6 things I've written down here that come up most often. First of all, parents hate bad tempers in their children, or wrong attitudes, we might say. Then they hate, secondly, children that answer back, sassy. Thirdly, they hate arguments among siblings. Parents hate it when the kids argue among themselves. That's the subject of the next parenting study, I think. Depends on what Mr. Pate is doing. But we did talk about doing that. I believe that, isn't that next week? Next week is the parenting study, and we may well get to that issue about what happens when children argue among themselves in the family environment. Number 4, disobedience is what hassles parents most about their children. Number 5, asking for things that the parents can't afford. That's a burden. And number 6, emotional upsets, just emotional situations. So bad tempers, answering back, arguments among siblings, disobedience, asking for things we can't afford, and emotional upsets. They are the 6 most often cited things that parents dislike or that hassle them about their children. It's true to say that many, many parents today are cold and distant from their children. Now, it may always have been so. You may find in the 100-year rule it was worse. So I know if your parents weren't warm to you, it'll be very hard for you to be warm to yours. And so it goes. And to change that will take mighty effort. It can be done, but you'll have to be very conscious of it. Quality time is very, very rare. In fact, one researcher said this, and I thought this was interesting. One researcher said, there is no such thing as a meaningful relationship with a teenager. Sorry, kids. You can take that as a blanket statement from one person. You may have a very, very good relationship with your teens. I hope you do. But by and large, it's a statement that will come up frequently, that there is no such thing as a meaningful relationship with a teenager because they're in such a transitional state and they may or may not respond in a certain way. 1 in 5 parents feel that their children lying is a very disturbing trend or position to be in. You do get the parents that say, oh, my child would never lie to me. And you wonder how blind the parent would be or how wonderful the angel is that they're rearing, as the case may be. But most parents are very disturbed by that. And on the other hand, most parents are very frank and candid with their children. Most parents try to be open and honest. And 85% of parents believe they can discuss right and wrong with their children. So there's a certain ability to be candid and straightforward and to bring things out in the open that way. So although there are conflicts here, although 85% feel they can be candid with their children and they can be frank with them, 85% of parents also find discussing sex, drugs and bereavement almost impossible. So they can be candid and frank in a subject they're content with or happy with, but if it comes to bereavement or drugs or sexual issues, then they find that very, very difficult to handle. 85% of parents said so. Parents shudder at the very thought of their children taking drugs, joyriding, or getting into vandalism. Excuse me. They're the real big fears. Taking drugs, joyriding, or vandalism. Well, again, if the family is a family unit working together, those things can certainly be minimized, if not eradicated. You know, there's a movement in society today to decriminalize marijuana, which you probably know is pretty widespread in its use. But it is still dangerous. And it is still far more dangerous than cigarette smoking. And one thing I would have thought would have put young people off from marijuana smoking was it slow down your learning curve. You do not learn as much or as fast if you smoke marijuana. That's but one of its faults. Anyway, I'm not going to go on about that. I studied it at some length, and I'm a little bit aware of the situation there. But parents are most concerned about that type of involvement that their children can get into. And the decriminalizing set has it that marijuana is no worse than cigarette smoking, therefore why not let it happen? No, it's a problem. All right, well, those are some of the situations. How do we deal with these issues? How do we deal with them? I would say it's going to be very, very personal and extremely individual as to what we may or may not do in given situations. Overly corrected children tend to become problem teenagers. Overly corrected tend to be problem teenagers, except in New Zealand. They did a parallel survey in New Zealand and found the opposite, which tells you a lot about the Kiwis. It also tells you a lot about us, whichever way you care to read it. Perhaps it tells you a lot about surveys. But the New Zealand survey said that overly corrected children respond very well. In this country, it found that they did not, that they became problem teenagers. I would say the truth is that if you're on the lax side, you're a bit easygoing, you're more likely to wind up with troubles. But you've got to find that balance, obviously, within your own family. Most parents do correct their children. There's no doubt about that. Sometimes too often. The important thing is to make any correction fit the child in question, to fit the particular issue and the child in question. I'll just give you some typical corrections that are fulfilled by most parents. The most often used punishments in descending order, or increasing order, shall we say, from the least to the greatest. The least used punishment for a child is corporal punishment. Next, not speaking to a child, send them to Coventry. The next one up the list is no pocket money. The next one up is smacking, which you might see as corporal punishment, but smacking is a smack. Corporal punishment is a little bit heavier. The next one up the list is you're not allowed to go out. You're confined to barracks or whatever it is. The next one up the list is you're given a work or a chore job to do. The next one up the list is there's no TV or no treats, no sweets. The next one up the list is you're sent to your room. And the top of the list is you're simply told off. So most often, kids are told off. Then they're sent to their room, or then there's no TV, or you're given a job, or you're not allowed to go out, you can't see your friends, or you're smacked, or you get no pocket money, or the parent won't speak to you, or you really get a thumping. And it just comes down that order. That's the general trend of what most parents would do. Parents do smack less often today, but one in three will occasionally smack, and that also is usually a younger child. Might also reflect on the church of the years going by, and whether we reflect society there in many, many ways, that we would probably smack a lot less often in the church today than we used to. A lot less often. Of that there'll be no doubt. Not surprisingly, you'll find in most homes the mother plays the largest role in bringing up the children. By far and away the largest role, although the domination of certain things is split. Mother dominates in clothing, eating, and emotional support. But the father still dominates in the education of the children and in their leisure activities. So dad still controls leisure and education. Mother controls just about everything else. And you might think your family has got it all together in all of these areas, but this is the trends of society today. The decline of the family value is said by many, many people to be the greatest threat to society today. The breakup of the family, the breakdown of the family, is being looked at as the greatest threat to society. Now you can argue it never was strong, it never was wonderful, and so on and so forth. You can argue, again, back 100 years or more. But nonetheless, it's being cited as an issue. So what I'm saying and repeating is that modern parenthood is very difficult in the culture we live in. We now have a situation in a culture where the single-parent family is very commonplace. It's not unusual to have single-parent families, but the point is being made that the other missing parent is missed. The missing parent is missed. Some go so far as to say, this is some researchers, some papers being written, they go so far as to say a relationship with one parent is unhealthy. And they're looking again at the 100-year rule, saying it's unhealthy. Now, you've got to look at all things in balance when you say those things, but people do look at facts and figures, and that's what they come up with. So, despite the mother's union that knocked the nuclear family, despite the senior Anglican clergy who said you can have sex outside of marriage, it doesn't care. Well, he may not have said that, but that's what's reported to have been said. Despite the Duchess of York, who says, well, I don't mind, my husband goes off another woman in front of the kids. Despite what we have in society with lesbians and other things, nonetheless, research tells us that the different family reaps a fruit that you don't really want. Not only that, there is a godly model which suggests two parents. If you look at the Bible, you do see a godly model of two parents. Not only that, but you see the extended family, which you can still have in single-parent families, and hopefully you do, aunts, uncles, and so on and so forth. But what do you see from Scripture? What does Scripture tell you? Well, it tells you that God cares for children. It tells you that God responds to children's needs. whether it's us or our children in that collective sense. God cares for us. He responds to our needs. He forgives us. He disciplines his children, it says that. He does comfort his children, and he does listen to his children. So you've got lots of umbrella statements from Scripture as to what God feels about people and families. Now, we all know that some families break down and some of us are left, well, you might be left an orphan. You know, these aren't things you can control. You're stuck with some things. And then you do your very best in that configuration to make it work out. And by and large, people do a very good job. No one's knocking that. And people are trying to be very encouraging. But when you look at the theory of these things, if you break a law, even if you're innocent, you do reap the penalty for it. That's the point, I think, that comes through. When you look at what research tells you and what the godly model is telling you as well. You break a law, you suffer. It may not be that you deserve it. It might be that you're getting the tough end of the stick, but you cop it as it goes. Look, in God's approach, let me read just two or three scriptures to you from John and Peter, beginning in 1 John 5. And just get a little bit of a sense of what God is able to project in the scriptures about family and the sensitivities to parent or child approaching God. Beginning in 1 John 5 and verse 14. I'm just picking out two or three scriptures here. 1 John 5:14. It says, "This is the confidence we have in approaching God. And as children, we are able to do that. That if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us." So, I'm using these scriptures because I want us to realize that there is a sense, you're not abandoned, you're not cut off, you're not isolated from God, but you can work through things and you can understand what the scripture says. So, he does hear us and we can approach him. And if we know that he hears us, whatever we ask, we know that we have what we asked of him. You know you've been heard. All right, so that's important. In whatever status you're in life, whether you feel hard done by, whether you feel oppressed, whatever it may be, that there is that relationship with God. Now, if you go back to Peter, and I'll just go back in descending order, 1 Peter 5 and verse 7. It says this, it says, "Cast all your anxiety on him because he cares for you." So you know that God is supportive. This is just to reinforce the principle of what the godly model is about. Cast your cares on him because he is there for you in that way. And also back into 1 Peter 2 and verse 10. 1 Peter 2 and verse 10. It says, "Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God." All right, so somewhere back in the 100-year spectrum, you may or may not have been in the church, in the family, or with the understanding of God, but now you are. And you can begin to change and reshape and remodel what you hope to achieve with your offspring. "Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." So even if your past is flawed, there is a relationship with God. That, I think, is the essence of those scriptures. Wouldn't matter what your past was, wouldn't matter what your difficulty was, whether it's today or 100 years ago, there has to be a turnaround point at some stage. There has to be an access point to God where you don't feel cut off and isolated and totally helpless. These scriptures, I think, tell us that. That there is an opening and an opportunity to begin to move things around. Now, the world will talk about this in terms of self-esteem. If you want self-esteem in your children, you can boil it down to some very simple skills. And they are these. You treat people with respect, whether it's your peers or your children, and in particular your children. You treat them with respect. You appreciate them. And you are straight and you're honest with them. Straight, honest, appreciation, and you have what you can spend hours and hours and hours researching for and looking for in people. Now, one man just isolates all of this and he calls it the PIN system, the PIN number. You're all familiar with your bank PIN numbers and things like that. Well, PIN, P-I-N, to this researcher is this: positive, interesting, negative. And so when dealing with people, or children in particular, he'll say it this way. He'll say, pin, positive, say something positive. I, for interesting, point out something interesting in what's happening. Maybe an original idea or something like that, or an original concept that the child or the person may have. And three, the negative, the N, you comment on that if necessary. So the pin system of building this self-esteem, of respect and appreciation and so on, is to do with this aspect of being positive, interesting, and then negative if you need to be. Say something positive, point out the interesting things, and comment on the negative if you need to. I have found that if a child is always praised, and they praise them, and you know there's a certain movement to do that, they found that sometimes with some children, when they get to be adults, they expect to be praised for the rest of their life. And then when they're adults and they're not told how wonderful they are for the rest of their lives, they burn out, go bananas. No one loves me anymore, because no one's telling them how wonderful they are every 5 minutes. So you have to be careful with the relationship issues, that you don't take one thing and run it off in a direction that becomes an issue and a problem to you later on. Most children will see things in very, very black and white terms. Very black and white. If something goes wrong, they will assume it's their fault or they're bad. That will be assumed. Now, you may not imply that or mean that, but it will be assumed, unless you've got a rapport, you've got this respect, appreciation and so on that you're working through, otherwise it might be taken on board. It's not easy. It's not easy. And that's why I say it's very individual, and you have to work your way through that. I would say perhaps try to be positive is about the best way to analyze the whole thing. Just try and be positive about it. Now, if the parents could pin back their ears, here's a list of things that children most would like to see in their parents. And it's quite a long list. It goes like this. Let me know you love me and value me. Don't nag me, otherwise I'll switch off and not listen. When I do something wrong, don't make me feel really, really bad, because everyone makes mistakes. I hate it when you tell me how good, talented or responsible other children are. If you make a promise to me, don't break it. Don't tell me off in front of others, it makes me feel really stupid. I know I say I hate you sometimes, but I don't really mean it. Don't give me everything I want, I'm just pushing to see how far I can go. Don't keep changing the rules, otherwise I get confused about what I can and can't do. Don't take it out on me when somebody else upsets you. Some of my aches and pains are just for attention. Do show me hugs and cuddles sometimes, as I need to feel the warmth of your love. If I'm really worried or upset about something, don't tell me it's stupid, because it isn't to me. If you're worried or upset about something, don't pretend nothing is wrong, because that makes me anxious. And finally, don't stay angry with me for too long, because I need your acceptance and love. Now, they're very adult comments, but they're what teenagers and children say about their parents consistently. They come up in lists over and over again, and they're big issues. Now, to me, healthy parenting includes this: clear beliefs, held firmly, but not rigidly. So you have a clear idea where you're going. You firmly believe them, but you're not rigid. You can change if there's a need to. Also, it involves consistent behavior. The parent has to have consistent behavior patterns. Also, there is a balance between reason and emotion. If you're all emotion, you'll lose them. If it's all logic and black and white and there's no emotion, you'll lose them. There's got to be a balance between emotion and reason. There's a movement between the two. A sense of feeling what is required. There has to be an interaction with other people. It cannot be all one-sided or all the way you see it. It has to be an interaction. You do have to be non-judgmental toward others who believe and behave differently. And we've touched on that in terms of perhaps the subject of forgiveness and other areas. So non-judgmental, it doesn't mean you agree with what they do, but you don't judge them for it. Doesn't mean you go along with it. Don't misunderstand what's being said. You do have to be responsible for your own actions. This is parenting. You do have to have the ability to forgive. That's most important. You do have to have the ability to see your own faults objectively. And very few do. See your own faults objectively. Or as somebody else put it, if we saw ourselves the way God sees us, we might get a shock. And you do have to have the ability to express and serve compassion. To express compassion. Now look, you could add to that list. It's a never-ending list. It just goes on and on. Francis Bacon, many, many years ago, said this. He said, "The joys of parents are secret, and so are their griefs and fears." The joys of parents are secret, and so are their griefs and fears. In other words, it can be very demanding, and it can also be very lonely. It can be quite stressful. You do have to keep moving your myths to one side. If there are things you've got in your 100-year history which are wrong, you've got to keep shoving them out. If you have ideas that don't work, remove them. If you have things that really are not working or that are antagonizing or disturbing people, then those things have to be moved also. You do have to keep building up what you would require and what you would see as godly parenting traits. And you evaluate them from the godly model, which I commented on, as to what God would expect. And it is a model of care and concern, and those things are most important. So I'm not going to give you any more lists and things. I think I've probably said enough. But I wanted to mention a little bit about child rearing and about parenting in this way, in this context. That it is a difficult area. It's a demanding area. It's a moving area. It's an area where society is changing quite rapidly, where things are becoming more and more acceptable out there that you may or may not agree with. You can find yourself drifting with some of them, or you can find yourself opposing it. When you could meet, for instance, two lesbians with a couple of children, and you could say the children are very well behaved, therefore it works. Or you could say, in 100 years' time, I wonder what will happen with the end result of that relationship, because it is not based on the godly model. So it's difficult. It becomes personal. You can offend people very quickly, and you can cause great distress with some people and some families and some environments. But it is an area to be most concerned about within your own relationships. You do have to be concerned for your own marriage, and you do have to be concerned for your own children. And having said that, I'd like to close by a few comments and say that really all you can do is strive to be the very best parent you can. Doesn't mean you'll be perfect. It doesn't mean you won't make mistakes. But you do have to be able to hold your head up at the end of it and say, well, I did my very best. And by and large, I think we do have success rate which is very, very high. We aim then to produce a healthy child who in turn will marry and produce hopefully an even healthier family and a better environment again than we ever provided ourselves. We hope that things go on in that way. I do think that throughout parenting and throughout child rearing, one of the greatest things you can have is a very large dose of common sense. You do need a very, very level head and a very placid nature to be able to cope. Lots of common sense. Read about that, think about that, and consider it, because it will take you through many of the hurdles which in time then level out to be non-issues. And you can make mountains out of molehills, so pick your battles with great care. Some parents will pick a battle with a child on every single issue, and you wind up with a battlefield. My advice is choose your battles with care, and if you want to fight an issue, fulfill it. But it doesn't mean you have to fight every battle on every issue, on every point, every time. So But you do have to find your level of common sense in the relationships that you will have within your family and indeed your extended family. With the godly model, your family should be surrounded by concern and love. And you can boil it down to very simple sentences like that. Your family, the model that God sets, is a relationship between you and your children, the children and you, the extended family, the people that you know, whether it's in the church, in your own family, whatever it may be. It's based on concern and love. And you work your way through the issues from there, because that is the essence of God's Spirit in us. And that's our potential, and that's our ability. Now, I hope that all of us, as the years go by, do increase and improve and prosper in that sense of relationships within the family. I hope we all wind up in this theoretical sense of having a good rapport with our children and our grandchildren. You know, sadly, many of us don't. There are some families where the grandchildren are never seen because the alienation is so deep. It's removed. They've gone. They may never be seen again. There are some families where parent and child are never reconciled, even to the point of death. They are never reconciled because the hurt was so deep and so profound. So common sense is a byword. And I don't use the word lightly. I use it very, very keenly and strongly, because that is the leveling ground for all of these issues and points. And if we're all mindful of that, and you get these principles in mind as to where we're going, it makes it a lot easier. So parenting can be lonely, it can be difficult, but it can be done. It can also be very encouraging and very rewarding. So let's hope we all wind up with some big, big smiles on our faces as the years go by. Happy parenting.